The Daily Maverick Show on cliffcentral.com. Stay informed and up to date. It's the Daily Maverick Show, Tuesdays 1 to 2 p.m. on cliffcentral.com.
Good afternoon. You're tuned in to the Daily Maverick Show on Cliff Central. As usual, I'll be your host for the next hour, Kingsley Kipuri. We've got quite a packed show lined up. We'll be talking about the ANC National General Council that happened this past weekend. Lots of talking points from there, including South Africa potentially withdrawing from the ICC. Also some succession conversation. Could we possibly have a female president? Also talk about a wealth tax and still the ongoing debate about e-tolls and what's going to happen with that. In addition, we'll be talking about the traditional Khoisan leadership bill that came before a parliamentary commission a couple of weeks ago. And there's been a lot of back and forth about whether that's something that's actually good for the country. Or is it just entrenching some of the sort of apartheid era Bantustan formations that we as a country are trying to move away from. So lots of talking points. I'm joined in studio by Ranjeni Munisami. Ranjeni, welcome to the show.
Hi, King. Good to be here again.
We've had you twice in just a couple of weeks.
We're
doing something right.
Yeah, I'm feeling... You know, quite chuffed about that because you guys were ignoring me for a long while.
And yet here you are. And you are.
Yeah,
you are
actually, thanks to the ANC, you know. The ANC delivers, as you can see. Delivered me to Cliff Central.
Good story to tell. Yeah. You must have had such a busy weekend.
Oh, it was incredible. But it's also so fascinating. You know, the ANC is really like no other organization. It's the ruling party. You know, it's in control of all government institutions. And yet there's one thing that they consistently never, ever get right, and that's accreditation. So what happens is that they ask you to register weeks in advance, okay, which you do, okay, knowing, oh, I'm doing this. This is just, you know, useless exercise. It's going to be for nothing because we're going to end up standing in queues for hours. And then they do everything manually. So, you know, that you have to brace for that. And, you know, with 4,000 people there during the heat wave, it is not fun. You know, to stand in queues and things, but you know, overall it's worth it because to be there in that space, it's amazing to see the power networks work and, you know, the politically powerful moving in their own, you know, amongst their own, and you know, who associates with who and who's chatting with who, and you know, all the behind the scenes lobbying that goes on. So it was a really, really fascinating time.
Yeah, I think it's sometimes hard for outsiders to really gauge the mood, because when we read some of the newspaper reports and so on, it sounds like a very sort of critical, internally critical, sort of dialogue heavy occasion. But then you see the pictures and people are just cozying up and there's lots of selfies. I think I saw Gwede Mantashe pouting in a picture.
No, I mean, there's a lot of exuberance and excitement because it's not very often. I mean, basically every 5 years, the ANC has an elective conference, and in between, they have the National General Council. So you don't have a gathering of that magnitude very often. So, you know, it's everybody getting together. And as you know, when the ANC sings, you know, the songs of struggle and things, it can be really moving, and everybody gets worked up, and you know, you can't help being to go with the mood. But the problem is when the discussions start, you know, and when they buckle down on it, and that's the real problem, because there's some very, very controversial decisions that they're taken. And on the other hand, you know, you can't help feeling disappointed that the ANC is not still getting to grips with some key issues like unemployment and poverty levels in the country, and I would say corruption.
I just, before we get into that, there was some back and forth just before the conference, if I'm not wrong, about whether the organizational report and the political report would be open to the media. And I'm curious as to what is the purpose of bringing this thing and saying this is our stance if it's not going to be open to...
Well, you know, on Thursday, we were all in quite a state because they had a pre-briefing by Gwede Mantashe. And he says, we are not yet sure whether the political report will be open to the media. The organizational report is definitely not open to the media. So when you look at the program that they had just distributed, it meant that the national anthem and the opening prayer would be the only things open to the media. So, you know, why go through that entire process when the thing's going to be shut down? So when we questioned it, they said, well, you know, the president likes to have an intimate discussion with his members, and he doesn't, you know, when he's open to the public, he's fond of saying, oh, if the media was not here, I'd be saying much more, and things like that. So that's why they want this to be an open and frank discussion, and therefore they were considering that the media not be there. But obviously, that was going to cause a massive rebellion. And, you know, so I don't think the media would have accepted that. So I think just to, you know, to prevent that kind of headbutting session, they then decided, okay, they will open the president's report to the media, but the organizational report would still be secret. But I must say, after the president started delivering the report, I realized why they considered keeping it a secret.
Why?
Because,
tell us.
Well, the massive revelation in that report was that ANC membership had dropped from 1.2 million members to 768,000. Now, in all the times I've done political reporting, I've never, ever heard any organization admit publicly that they've had a drop in support. People always claim, even COPE, you know, when it's in its dying phase, will claim that its membership is growing. Even Ahang will say its members are still there. You know, so for the ANC, which is the governing party, to admit that publicly, you know, it's unprecedented. So it means that they were trying to ring the alarm bells amongst their members to say, guys, things are going horribly wrong. We need to do something. This NGC needs to come up with big decisions and quick decisions. Otherwise, we're going to be losing even more support. So yeah, I think that would be have been the one thing that I don't think they would have wanted to keep secret. But you could see by the next day, they realized that they were backtracking on it because they realized that maybe it wasn't that good an idea to reveal it publicly, because the ANC Deputy Secretary General, Jesse Duarte, then went on a massive spin exercise, you know, going like bouncing around media houses, all of us camped out there, saying, actually, no, it's a misunderstanding. You know, this is an unaudited, the 760,000 figure is actually just audited figures as of April. The real figures are over 1.3 million. So actually we've grown. But you could see that was just a spin exercise. You know, you can't claim people will fall in off your database. Lapsed members are saying, no, they're still there. Don't worry, they're still there.
I mean, it sounds encouraging, honestly. Spin aside, that organization will stand there and say, listen, guys, our membership has dropped and it spells trouble and we need to shape up.
Yes, I mean, that sounds it's quite an admission.
The reflection and the being self-critical.
It means that they, you know, it wasn't just a whole, you know, going through the motions exercise. It was a real emergency situation saying that 37% of our members are no longer, we can technically call our members. So, you know, we have to do something drastic. The question to be asked is, at the end of this meeting, can you really say that though all those members who are lapsed would be running back to the ANC now?
I think that's a tough one. Jesse Duarte would say they were there the whole time, so we're good. And that
also linked to the topic of corruption, which came up quite a bit. Other perception, there was a lot of talk of corruption or perception of corruption.
Yes, and the president himself spoke about it, you know, that what he calls traditional supporters were being turned off the party because of various perceptions, including corruption. But, you know, my concern, King, is that the ANC seems to have vested all its faith in terms of dealing with corruption and misconduct by its members in what they call an integrity commission, which is a good idea because it's an independent body that's going to look at any member. And from what, for example, Nomvula Mokonyane told us, these people won't only be making decisions based on the outcome of court cases. So even if somebody is charged, they're going to be able to call that person in and say, listen, this is a very serious charge. We think you should step down from your position. So anybody who damages the image of the party, that integrity commission is saying, you're interfering with the integrity and the image of the party, please step aside. So it's to do some sort of cleanup. The problem with that is that when you look at who the members of this integrity commission are, and you have to feel sorry for them, it's chaired by former Rivonia trialist Andrew Mlangeni, who is 90 years old. You know, and other members like Abed Katrada was 86, Dennis Goldberg was 82, Gertrude Schoppe was 90 also. I mean, these poor people.
So that's an average age of about 85 years old. The commission.
These poor people. you know, they've given so much to the ANC, to the country. They've dedicated their lives to struggle. Now in their golden years, in their retirement, you know, where they should be sitting back in the shade, yes, somewhere, rocking well on a chair.
Retirement. Yes.
Now they've been called back to say, no, investigate these people, throw them out. And you know, the thing is that you can just imagine somebody was accused and is going to be able to say, but I didn't do this. Or, you know, what about the president? He was able to keep his job. What about, you know, so-and-so, John Block? He was supposed to get, now why must I go? So he's going to be fighting these poor old people. And it's their responsibility to clean up the image of the ANC.
I mean, so one, what, we have no indication that they are able to police themselves. The ANC is able to police themselves.
Yeah, but this is the thing, you see.
And two, why do they need to go back to people who are 80, 90
yes,
years
exactly.
old? Are those the only people who they deem? So they're self-admitting that these are the only people with integrity.
Exactly. That's exactly what they say. And, you know, the thing is that when you look at the ANC and how it operates, you would expect that they have a current a National Executive Committee of 80 members. They have, you know, what they call the top six, the ANC president, deputy president, secretary general, national chairperson, the deputy and the treasurer. Why are they not running the organization? Why are they not acting with integrity? Or why are the provincial secretaries and the provincial chairpersons the ones who are not saying, listen, you are accused, please step aside? Why are they like calling out these poor old people to come out of their retirement and basically act as the great police people over the ANC?
The big question.
Yeah.
It's 1:17. If you're just joining us, it's the Daily Maverick Show on Cliff Central. Remember, you can tweet us on @DMShowZA and you can give us a call on 0861-555-89. We're talking about the ANC's National General Council that took place over the weekend. Ranjani is here with us and she was right there on the front lines experiencing the action. Ranjani, something really big that came out, and Twitter was you know, on fire with this talk of South Africa potentially withdrawing from the ICC.
Well, let me describe to you what is going on. So on Sunday, it was the last day of the NGC. And so on Saturday, the NGC basically broke up into various commissions. On Sunday, they were reporting back to the plenary of the NGC on these commissions. So as the plenary approved each commission's report, they then come down to the media center, which is on the other side of Gallagher Estate, and then present to us. So we had 9 media briefings back to back. Which was really intense. I mean, you have to sit there and, you know, train your mind to pay attention to all this avalanche of information coming at you. And all of it is important because all of it has to do with basically the running of the country. So here comes the, it was the International Relations Committee. The people who were presenting to us was the International Relations Minister, Maite Nkwana-Mashabane, and the chairperson of the International Relations Committee, which is Obed Papela. So they start, you know, talking, you sit there, you start taking notes, and then suddenly Papela says, oh yeah, the one thing you may be interested in is that the ANC has decided that we're going to withdraw from the International Criminal Court.
By the way.
And you basically see, like, you know, 50 journalists, like, simultaneously just go, wah! You know? You can't even type fast enough. You know, like people are running out to do like quick radio broadcasts. It's a major breaking story.
Yeah.
You know, South Africa was there at the inception of the ICC. It was really one of the platforms where we could say we had the moral high ground. You know, being there at the inception and trying to protect human rights throughout the world. And this decision has basically been prompted by the ICC's issuing of a warrant of arrest for the Sudanese president Omar al-Bashir. But the ANC's reasoning is that the court operates unfairly. It targets African leaders. Basically, the world powers can't be bothered to even be members, let alone abide by the rulings of the court. So, you know, why should the rest of the world pay attention? The thing is that I think South Africa and the ANC would have maintained the moral high ground if they had said that on principle. The problem is that this whole controversy was prompted by a war criminal basically cruising into our country and then leaving in our country in violation of a ICC warrant and a domestic court order.
Yes.
So, you know, that's the problem, because now it looks as if this is a way to be able to get out of this legal conundrum that the South African government finds it. So the thing is, okay, so the ANC wants to, it can't just immediately withdraw. The processes that it needs to go through.
I think, because the ANC and the state are separate, so it will take some time and go through Parliament.
Yes,
and,
it'll have to go through Parliament. Yeah. It will have to be approved by the National Assembly, National Council of Provinces. But in the meantime, that does not exonerate the South African government from the fix it is in now, where it is in violation of a high court order, and that the warrant, it violated the ICC warrant. So it has to respond to these two things still. So whatever the ANC decides, and what this decision, and it is a dramatic decision, it doesn't release the government from the what has already happened now.
I think what really bugs me is just that this often goes in hand with the argument that the ICC only prosecutes Africans and that it's designed to oppress Africa. And people always forget that countries often nominate or take their own presidents to these places.
Yes, that's true.
Or have a chance. Like, I remember Kenya had a window and it was like, okay, please self-prosecute. You have this much time. Kofi Annan came, everybody shook hands. At the end, it's like, did you prosecute? No. Then you must go to the ICC. And then later you pretend to be a victim.
And the ANC is basically saying that it's following the lead of the African continent, because the AU is going through the same process. There's consideration throughout the province throughout the continent that there could be a withdrawal. But the thing is that Africa doesn't have an alternate platform at the moment. They're supposed to have an African Court of Justice that will perform the same function of prosecuting war criminals, protecting the violations of human rights, but they don't have that at the moment. And so so you're going to have a vacuum unless they pull up their socks and have this in place quickly. You know, that means that there wouldn't be justice and any kind of process for victims of human rights violations to resort to.
I mean, it's definitely a long way before we have the court set up. It's possible. It takes a while and it needs to be funded by somebody. So the ICC is funded by the EU, and somebody will have to step up and actually fund the court.
Yes, exactly.
Which is not a cheap endeavor.
No, it's not.
And then imagine African presidents holding each other to account and prosecution.
That will be fun to watch.
And Jenny, something else that came out of this was this talk of a media tribunal.
Oh, yes, that was another shock.
I mean, so there's been antagonism between the ANC and the media for a while. I know you've been caught up in that once or twice. So tell us about the media tribunal, what's going on.
Okay, so this basically came about from the ANC's Polokwane conference in 2007. That's when it was first mooted. And obviously the media were like shrieked about this and tried to fight it off. And since then, there have been various processes to show that the other methods of holding the media to account, such as self-regulation and co-regulation. And the media has been trying to beef up mechanisms that are there already to ensure accuracy and fairness and things like that in reporting. But this didn't make much headway at the 2012 conference. It kind of fell off the agenda there. But it's front and center again. It was presented to us via one of the ministers who was also on the ANC's communications committee, Lindiwe Zulu. So again, it was another bombshell there. We were merrily typing.
By
and
the
then
way.
It says, yes. There was a strong feeling in the NGC that the Media Appeals Tribunal, should be placed back on the agenda, and that Parliament should investigate the feasibility and desirability. So again, you find like the entire media contingent wanting to shriek in horror, because the thing is, the shocking thing about this is what she said immediately after announcing this.
Yeah.
She says that there's a lot of negativity in the media, and hopefully this Media Appeals Tribunal will deal with that. Now, Kingsley, the Media Appeals Tribunal is there to deal with people who have grievances. So if there is inaccurate reports, there were things that are not factually correct, the media doesn't want to retract it. So that means that that an ordinary person or ordinary politician then has a platform to go and take this thing up. It is not there to deal with negativity in the media. So if you don't like the Daily Maverick, for example, and feel, oh, we're being too critical of President Jacob Zuma, you can't just go there to a Media Appeals Tribunal and say, yes, you have to be more positive in your reporting. That's not how it works. But there seems to be a fundamental misunderstanding from the ANC, even about its own platform it wants to introduce. The ANC genuinely believes that it can sway this, you know, tsunami of negative reporting about the ANC through this draconian measure. Instead of saying, let's look at what's causing the negative reporting. Let's deal with that. But they're not saying that.
Yeah, I really worry about this. So it's like, the press is too negative. Let's set up a body that basically
can punish them.
Punishes them for being negative.
Yes.
And, you know, put in more good news stories.
Yes.
Like this, by force.
So basically we'll have the Shlaudi Motsoeneng formula of having 70% good news. And if you stray from that formula, then you get hauled before the Media Appeals Tribunal.
Jeez.
And, you know, there's that on one hand.
Yep.
And then there's the Protection of State Information Bill, which is still hovering above us. So with that bill has basically gone through a parliament. It's been approved. It's sitting on the president's desk for about 2 years waiting for his signature. So it's another axe hanging over the media. Because with that legislation, journalists can be jailed. And you can see that, like, what's happening in other parts of the world, like in Turkey at the moment, you know, where editors are just arrested. There's an editor-in-chief of the main English newspaper in Turkey at the moment who has been jailed for tweets. So, you know, you worry whether South Africa is heading that way, you know, with these two things now hovering above us. We don't know when the president can decide, where's that document I lost on my desk? Let me pick it up and, like, just put it, because that's all it's going to take for him to sign it. And then it's law.
Jeez, I wonder how many 12Fs just drop their iPhones when you mention going to jail for tweets.
Yes, exactly.
It's just before 1:30, it's 1:27, and you're in the Daily Maverick show on Cliff Central. We're talking to Ranjeni Munusami, who was on site at the ANC National General Council over the weekend, and is just basically talking us through the big talking points. Ranjeni, Eats Alls is always a big one, and there's been a bit of a clash between Gauteng's policy or Gauteng's approach, the ANC Youth League's approach, and the national sort of approach. Is this something that played out over the weekend?
Yes, well, I was lucky to have an interview with the ANC provincial chairperson, Paul Mashatile, earlier in the week, last week, ahead of the NGC. And he basically threw down the gauntlet, which he said that the Gauteng province still did not believe that the compromise position negotiated by the deputy president Cyril Ramaphosa, you know, that they approved of it, so they still had serious reservations about it, and they said that they do not approve of the system of ETALs in its current form. Now, you must know that that system was it came about following the investigation by the Gauteng Premier David Makura, and that the report of that that investigation was then processed by the national government, and they came up with a set of compromise positions. Mm-hmm. But that hasn't been implemented yet. So I don't know. I don't pay ETOLs. I don't even know what's going on. But when I don't know what happens when you drive under it, whether that purple thing can read, whether it must go under the discounted rate, or if the bills come out under the discounted, but apparently it's not. So Gauteng, when they're saying, listen, something else needs to happen, because this is not working out, guys. And so the end result was that it's gonna stay, that the user pay principle has to stay. That the big problem is that the Department of Transport hasn't implemented this compromise package, so people haven't felt the effect of it, and that is why people are still aggrieved about it. And that further investigation needs to be done. What this says is, if you're not paying ETOLs, don't pay it yet. I'm sorry to be
broke.
You heard it here. Yeah.
You're fine. Don't worry about it.
Yeah, because clearly, you know, nobody knows what's going on in the ANC or the government. Nobody knows who's supposed to pay what. What's supposed to be... Because previously, at the gathering, for example...
Yeah.
Paul Mashatile said there that all people who are in debt at the moment, who have this tons of ETOL, unpaid ETOL bills, we need to check what happens to that.
Absolutely. And so, it's supposed to be a maximum. You must not pay more than
exactly.
X amount every month.
So, you know, it's all up in the air. So... I'm definitely not going to go and, you know, go and take a loan to go and settle on my unpaid ETOL bills.
Well, luckily, you know the Premier personally. So I suppose that helps.
No, I don't think if you get arrested that you can
call him.
Yeah, you can call him and say, please, can bail me out.
I need a solid. It's just after 1:30. please tweet us on @DMShowZA. We're loving the interaction on there. Now, Ranjani, I want to ask about, of course, the big question, which is succession. So going into it, there were lots of rumors. Is Gwede Mantashe going to be the deputy? Is Susana Dlamini Zuma going to be the president? What's going on? There was so much chatter going into the council, but also insisting that the purpose of the council is not to discuss succession.
Yes.
So is there still backroom chatter? Did people just say forget it and still talk about succession anyway?
A lot of backroom chatter.
Yeah.
One very interesting thing happened during the NGC is that President Zuma was on a walkabout in the precincts, you know, just checking on everyone, saying hi to
that
everyone.
Sounds nice.
So he came cruising past the media center. So one journalist then asked him, so President Zuma, do you think you'd be running for a third term? Because some of the NC structures are considering nominating you for a third term. And he responded saying, never ever, even if they beg me, I won't stand. Which is quite definitive language. It's not like saying, I'll think about it.
The wishes of the party, which
is
always a good one.
It's very different to say never ever. However, there is a camp, as you know, called the Premier League in the NC, which he has, made no bones about the fact that they want President Zuma to stay on for at least another 2 years more as ANC president. So his term of office comes to an end in 2017. So they want him to stay on till at least 2019. So he hasn't said no to that. He has said no to running for a third term as ANC leader. But the other thing is that every ANC leader that you know of from Mandela onwards always says, I'll follow the will of the ANC. Mm. So if things fall apart completely and nobody wants to stand, for example, President Zuma would then stand. But what we do know is that the two front runners, Nkosazana Dlamini Zuma and Cyril Ramaphosa. Now, Nkosazana Dlamini Zuma has been very, very present and vocal in South Africa recently. So she appears to be wanting the job and she appears to be trying to warm up her constituencies to the possibility.
Yeah, you wouldn't even know she's based in Addis.
She's here all the time. Yes. And she had quite a quite a presence on the stage at the NGC as well. It's difficult not to notice her, and she's very presidential in the way she carries herself already. And then there's poor Cyril Ramaphosa.
Why poor?
You have to feel
a lot of things, but not someone that you should feel sorry for.
No, yeah, I suppose that's the wrong word to describe Cyril Ramaphosa. But you have to feel sorry for him.
What?
You know, he's so boxed in at the moment. He can't be seen to be campaigning. He can't say a single word that shows that he's interested in life after being deputy president. All he does is praise President Zuma for his leadership. He doesn't have a constituency. So nobody has basically said so far, we want Cyril Ramaphosa. But you've had a lot of people saying, we want Nkosazana Dlamini Zuma. So he's not able to respond to this. He's not able to campaign. So, yeah. For now, I think we can refer to him as poor Cyril Ramaphosa.
I mean, the Women's League has made no apologies about sort of openly saying what they're going for, which I like.
But they haven't said that they're backing her. They've said they want a woman president, but she appears to be the front runner.
I really like that. Like, I mean, the Women's League has been accused of just being a non-entity for so long.
Yes,
and I'm
exactly.
Excited that they're out there front and center and they're being sort of open about what they want.
You know? No. They definitely have grown up in the last few months.
Grown up.
And making their presence felt.
Absolutely. It's 1:35. You're tuned to the Daily Maverick Show on Cliff Central. We're going to go into a really, really quick break and we'll be back talking about the traditional and Khoisan leadership bill.
Stay informed and up to date. It's the Daily Maverick Show, Tuesdays 1 to 2 p.m. on cliffcentral.com.
Good afternoon. You're back with me, Kingsley Kipuri, on the Daily Maverick Show on Cliff Central. We've been talking about the ANC National General Council that took place over the weekend. We're going to switch topics quickly and talk about the traditional and Khoisan leadership bill that was put before a parliamentary commission last week. We'll be talking to Aninka Klaasens, Chief Researcher at the Center for Law and Society at UCT. Aninka, can you hear us?
Yes, I can hear.
How are you doing today?
I'm fine. How are you doing?
Fantastic. Now, Aninka, you have a long, long career in working on matters of land rights and especially in rural communities. So I'd love if you could just give us some context about this traditional and Khoisan leadership bill. What is it about? Give us some context and why does it matter?
It matters because it basically locks 18 million people, that's the number of people living in the former Bantustans, into the kind of tribal identities that were superimposed during apartheid by the Bantu Authorities Act.
Mm.
And that's very serious given the big mining boom that we are seeing and the irony that just about all the platinum is in the former Bophuthatswana, former Leboa, and the massive amounts of coal and iron ore are in the former KwaZulu and the former Kangwani. And basically this bill superimposes the tribal boundaries of old, the traditional leaders recognized during apartheid, and gives them completely unaccountable power over people living in those areas where the mining is taking place.
I mean, you've mentioned the one side, which people are saying that it just further entrenches the sort of the apartheid-style geography in the sort of Bantustan era. But on the other hand, some people are saying that, listen, some of these traditional authorities are there and these monarchies, and that sort of it's important to reflect this and acknowledge that these lines and these cultures are important and should have a role in the legal framework. What do you say to that?
Well, I mean, I'm sure that they are important in many areas and they are legitimate in many areas. But what this bill does is it completely cuts across the idea of customary law as a consensual system of chief's powers deriving from the people, which, you know, all the proverbs, Nkosi Nkosi Ngabantu or Morena Ke Morena Kabantu, all the proverbs say that chief's power derives from the support that people give them. And this bill does the opposite. It gives chiefs jurisdiction over people who were put under them during apartheid. And, you know, any traditional leader who is legitimate doesn't need that kind of power because his power will come from the people and the support that they provide. But what this bill does is it destroys all the community authorities that were created during apartheid, because even the apartheid government had to recognize that many African people purchased land before the 1913 Act or through exemptions from it, that there were different forms of social organization. And in many instances, people had communal systems without chiefs. This bill ignores that history, and it says that every person in those boundaries is the subject of one or other traditional leader, not according to their choice, but according to the apartheid boundaries. And then it gives them powers which, and at no point does it require that they consult the people who are bound by the decisions that they make on their behalf. And that too is completely opposed to customary law. Customary law provides for all sorts of inclusive decision-making processes, and it has never given a chief the right to unilaterally enter into a mining deal with a company and refuse to provide any kind of accounting to the people whose land is being ripped up by that mining.
I love that you brought up the mining deals. I mean, you've written and argued that, one, not only are a lot of these traditional councils not valid and not complying by the rules, but also you mentioned some communities where a lot of communities are reacting to some of these misdeeds and misrepresentation by traditional leaders.
Yes, because basically you've had a string of court judgments by traditional leaders who have suppressed people's opposition to these mining deals. They've said that people have no right to call meetings. They've interdicted people from calling meetings. They've said that even the people whose land is directly affected have no legal standing to challenge their decisions. And what we've discovered recently is that in Northwest, where you have 102 so-called traditional councils, none of their tribal books of accounts have been audited since 1994. Now, that is the place where you've had this massive platinum boom on communally owned land, and there has been no accounting of the profits. And people who go to court to try and get their books of account audited to find out what's happening to these mining profits are told they have no legal standing, and they're hit with punitive costs orders. And so you've seen these outbreaks where people have gone and they've burnt down the houses of traditional leaders out of frustration that there is no mechanism to hold these traditional leaders accountable, and yet they get this official recognition, and they interpret that to mean that they're the only people who can make decisions that affect people's lives. And in many instances in Northwest, people had bought that land. They were forced under tribes because there was something called the Sixth Native Rule that said that no group of more than six land buyers could purchase land as a syndicate or land buying group, except if they're affiliated with the tribe. Now, those traditional leaders that they were forced to affiliate with in order to buy the land are making decisions about land that they purchased and refusing to account for any of the profits. And this bill enables that to continue. And, you know, I mean, I think that it's a very, very cynical piece of legislation because it attempts to replace the law that was put in place in 2003, the Traditional Leadership and Governance Framework Act. And that law, you know, had a long preamble about transformation, democracy. It said that all of these structures must have elections for 40% of their members. And those elections just have been a shambles. There hasn't been one election in Limpopo 11 years later. So all of those tribal councils are not validly constituted. Yet government continues to pay salaries, continues to bolster their authority to make these unilateral decisions. And now, instead of going and reforming that situation by ensuring that elections are held, it repeals that law and replaces it with another one, which provides no kind of punishment or disincentive if people fail to hold elections.
Anika, do you think that it also, in a way, creates a parallel justice system? You know, I've heard, for example, in the case of King Dalindyebo, where some of the people who are defending him were saying that, you know, decisions are made by the tribal authorities or the traditional authorities, and you know, the people who basically the subjects of the king have to abide by those authorities' decisions rather than what South African law says.
Well, government tried to enact just such a law with the traditional court bill, and that law would have given officially recognized leaders like Dalindyebo the power to enforce any sanction that they like as long as they said it conformed with customary law. The bill was clearly unconstitutional, and it was rejected by Parliament. I mean, it's the first time that an ANC-sponsored piece of legislation has been rejected by Parliament. Because people said it provided for a completely parallel, two different parallel legal systems within South Africa. And once you've got two parallel legal systems, you've got completely unequal citizenship. In terms of that bill, Dalindyebo would have been able to argue that he was acting in terms of customary law. Those arguments wouldn't have succeeded because there are a whole lot of provisions in the Constitution that make customary law subject to the Bill of Rights and provide for, you know, the right to legal representation for people charged with criminal matters. But it is absolutely extraordinary that the former head of Controlesa, Kosipata Kilehulamisa, is saying that what Dalindyebo did is an expression of the African way of life. Because what he did was burn down people's houses, deliver the dead body of his son to a father whom he then fined a whole lot of cattle, and participate in attacking people. And this is what the traditional courts bill would have been allowed, would have tried to allow. And he's coming out very strongly, Controlesa is coming out very strongly to say that they're going to push that line of argument. At the moment, there is no prospect of success. But the traditional courts bill, had it been passed into law, would have made this a much more difficult case to prove and to fight.
I mean, I suppose the big question then is what do we actually need in a legislative sense? We don't want to just dismiss traditional leadership altogether. We want to make sure that sort of the poorest of the poor in rural areas are actually being represented accurately. And it sounds like this bill isn't that. So what would you recommend that we actually need?
Well, we have to go back to the nature of customary law. And the nature of customary law is a consensual system that people opt into and support because it provides institutions and you know, things that they trust and that they believe in. So what we're saying is customary law needs to be recognized as an opt-in system. And then your courts would be lawful because they would be presiding over people who'd opted into them. And basically, the current legislation locks people into these tribal boundaries and prohibits them from opting out. So all we need to do is turn that around and say, where these structures are legitimate, where people want to use them, where they do use them, they should have binding authority over those people, not over the land, not over the geography created by apartheid, which separated white from black South Africa. I mean, it's deeply ironic to take that as a measure of where customary law applies, because customary law must apply across South Africa, and we recognize as a family-based system, not just a system that props up autocratic forms of chiefly power.
Okay, Anika, we hear you. I really hope that's something we can move towards. Anika, thank you so much for making time, and please keep up the great work.
Thank you very much.
Fantastic.
Thank you.
It's 1:48 p.m., just going into the last sort of portion of the show, and we're talking about the traditional and Khoisan leadership bill. We just spoke with Anika Klaasens, chief researcher at UCT Center for Law and Society. Next, we'll be chatting to Colin Hobanye, the High Commissioner of the Khoisan Kingdom. Colin, can you hear us?
Yes, I can hear you.
Fantastic. Colin, I know we kept you on hold a bit. Thank you so much. Now, Colin, I suppose first big question is, could you tell us about the Khoisan Kingdom and your role as High Commissioner?
Well, I'm High Commissioner is actually a glorified Secretary General. I'm responsible for administrative stuff and basically performing the role that the company secretary would perform. The Khoisan Kingdom is a cultural organization consisting of members of the Khoisan community. We decided to change the structure about 6 years ago to incorporate all of the five groups and other groups of the Khoisan people. You know, the bill, and after some research done in 93, the National Khoisan Council came up with five main Khoisan groups, the Busman, Kurana, Krikwa, Cape Khoi, and I'm missing one. Sorry, the Busman, the Kurana, the Cape Khoi, and I'll get.
Colin, don't worry about it. I'm sure you can tweet it once you remember.
So I suppose.
Yeah, I mean, our big question is really, as we talk about the traditional and Khoisan leadership bill, there's a lot of questions around how traditional authorities should interact with the sort of regular, for lack of a better word, Roman Dutch law. And I'm interested, what are your thoughts on some of the conversations happening and being put before Parliament right now?
Okay, just a passing comment on the traditional law, the legal bill that you just discussed. We are still gaining a legal opinion on the bill. Because last time when it was removed from Parliament, we basically stopped all of those consultations. Just the Khoisan Kingdom feels that we are a little bit concerned with some of the intentions of the traditional courts bill, insofar as we do not want to see where serious crime occur in our communities, and especially in far-flung areas. That must prevent community members from approaching the courts and having elders and people sorting out serious cases like rape, like abuse, and all those issues. So, but we are consulting still on the traditional courts bill. On the traditional and Khoisan leadership bill that's currently also before Parliament. We feel that it is a good start. We are absolutely not in total agreement with a lot of the provisions in the bill. There are a lot of Khoisan leaders that feel that the Khoisan people or some of the Khoisan, their own group, shouldn't even support the bill. At this stage, it's neither here nor there, because it looks like it's going to be approved. But we definitely feel that it is a good start, because since the dawn of democracy, the Khoisan leaders have been left out of any meaningful leadership role in society. Now, this bill is not exactly doing what we want as a first prize, but what it's doing secondary is it provides for for the recognition of at least the leaders of the Khoisan people. And we think that is important. The other issue is like...
I'm sorry, Colin, if I can just jump in on a quick question there. Yes. You said it provides for the leadership of the Khoisan people, which is a start. But, I mean, we're talking, and part of the issues of the recognition of traditional courts is this issue that there becomes a sort of a divide between the leadership and the people they claim to represent, and where the leaders start acting out of interest and try to enrich themselves. Is that a worry that you have at the Khoisan Kingdom?
Listen, as I say, we are discussing a whole lot of how these will impact on each other. The traditional courts, where you're talking about that. In terms of the traditional leadership, leadership is a very powerful issue in your community, especially in your rural areas, and that is recognized to a very large extent. What we are saying that now this bill, what it provides is that with those people that have performed all these leadership roles, traditional roles, that has performed the traditional ceremonies, at least from the Khoisan side, that is not the black side of our societies, that has been recognized in various legislation previously, or currently it will be repealed by this bill. But now, bringing the Khoisan leadership into that mainstream, we are saying that is the start. That is where we see the positive in this whole affairs. So it's definitely not going to solve any leadership issues you may have, or any issues the one bill will have talking to the other bill or not, for that matter. But what it will do, it will bluntly saying, it will take our leaders and put them on the table. Because currently, Khoisan leaders are nowhere at any table in South Africa. We are talking, we are screaming our mouths off, we are doing whatever we do. What I can say is that at least this administration has seen it fit to accelerate that process. All the other issues are not off the table. And we will definitely continue to fight for those.
I hear you. We're talking to Colin Hobanye, High Commissioner of the Khoisan Kingdom. Colin, thank you for making time.
You're welcome.
Fantastic. We're just wrapping up the Daily Maverick Show on Cliff Central. Thanks for tuning in. Ranjani, thank you so much for making time.
My pleasure. It was great to be here.
Hopefully to have you soon and before the next NGC, I hope.
No, the next NGC, I think, is in 2021. Okay. So it may be sometime.
So hopefully before this. Yeah. Fantastic. Thank you all for listening. Remember, you can find the podcast. You can listen in on the app. Please share the content, and we'll see you next week, same time, same place.
The Daily Maverick Show on cliffcentral.com.